Good afternoon, everyone. I think we should start. My name is Sophie Turin, and I'm co-deputy director of the Centre of European Studies here. I am delighted to welcome Professor Bernard Ryan from the University of Leicester, especially as you've come straight from Leicester after a lecture between 9 and 10. It's pretty good. Thank you so much for paying us the visit. Professor Ryan, you are chair of the Migration Law and Law Network. Professor Ryan has recently held a British Academic Fellowship in 2016-2017 in relation to his research on employment law in a time of migration. He has explored the implications of Brexit for the common travel area and for immigration law, including the impact of Brexit on current EU residents. And he has also been researching the current and truly concerning EU migration crisis. And the topic of your talk today is the EU border crisis, questions for international migration law. Professor Ryan, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Sophie. Thanks to the Centre for the invitation to speak. I should say that Brexit is all over my thoughts, despite it not, the word not appearing anywhere in the slides. The last time I was in Cambridge was the day the Brexit referendum campaign started. There was an event at the centre which I was involved in. Remember that that time. And the last time I spoke, last two times I spoke on this topic, were 2.5 years ago, on the 25th of June 2016 and the 27th of June 2016. And the significance of those dates is that they're the days after the referendum. At that time, I was expecting to be working on the migration crisis, among other topics, including this and the work in employment law. And of course, then Brexit came along and just knocked everything out over. From my own research point of view. So I've probably been spending too much time thinking about some of the implications of Brexit for my field, for immigration law, since then, not just EU settled status, what's become known as EU settled status, but also some of the the issues in relation to Ireland, which I've researched in the past. So if I say this is work in progress, it's pretty slow progress. Blame Brexit for that, amongst along with everything else. But this occasion has enabled me to sort of think a bit further about some of the questions I already had in 2016 about some of the challenges for international law that the EU migration crisis and the response to it was throwing up. And there have been further developments, obviously, on both sides, both in the evolution of the crisis and the response, but also in certain legal developments. And I will speak to those. But I certainly don't have any answers. My interest, in fact, in a way, is to think about the evolution of international law relating to migration in this area, and how a protracted crisis, indeed this protracted crisis, along with several others in the world, this protracted crisis, what can it change things, and how does that happen? How does change come about? And so I'm kind of studying the process of evolution is what I'm trying to do anyway, more than sort of make a particular normative argument, maybe. Although I probably have views about where the law can go, but I'm perhaps more interested in the question of just how does international law get made and changed where you have a crisis, and indeed you have perhaps out of that crisis somewhat new questions being thrown up by events on the ground. So I want to focus specifically on the whole migration crisis since 2015, or indeed I would argue it dates back to 2011, all the way back to the Arab Spring. But I want to focus on the Central Mediterranean route, and because that's where I think certainly from an international law point of view, maybe it's different for EU law, but for international law, I think these are perhaps where the more difficult questions have been shown to be. For about a decade actually now, and so we're talking. People may not be very familiar with this, but we're talking about this rough area between Libya and the Italian island of Lampedusa, and Malta, and then Sicily beyond, and of course that's Tunisia, the country not more off there on the left. But I'm specifically focusing on the journeys from Libya towards Italy and Italian territory, which primarily would be Lampedusa, could as potentially be people trying to get to Sicily or ultimately being taken to Sicily after some operation in international waters. So I'm going to talk about the Hirsi case as the prequel. Some of you may know about that. It's an earlier round of cooperation between Italy and Libya. And then I'm going to talk about the whole question of rescue in this area and how the policy of the EU and Italy has been changing, has changed markedly several times in the past years, and what a legal response to that might be. And then I will talk about the question of cooperation between Italy and the EU more broadly and the Libyan authorities and what legal principles apply, which rights and other legal principles apply to that. As I said already, my interest is, broader interest is in, well, how can international law get made, get improved in this area? And some of you will no doubt know about the Hirsi case from 2012. It's about a previous era or period of cooperation between Italy and Libya. This was Gaddafi's Libya in relation to irregular migration by sea from Libya towards primarily Lampedusa. That cooperation had been ongoing for many years, but specifically in 2009, in order to, with a view to stopping arrivals from Libya, an agreement was entered permitting the Italian vessels to intercept migrant boats on the high seas and return them to Libyan ports. And Hirsi was challenged by Somali and Eritrean nationals to the first of those operations, which was in May 2009, eventually decided by the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights in February 2012. And it found, it crucially found that when in this operation where the people in question were taken off the migrant boats and onto several Italian state vessels, Navy and Coast Guards, that they were under the jurisdiction of Italy from that point. And as a result, all of the obligations, potentially, of the European Convention applied. And as a result of that, there were breaches of Article 3, which prohibits, among other things, the return of someone to face inhuman or degrading treatment in another place, and Article 4 of Protocol 4, which prohibits collective expulsion. So the Article 3 breaches related both to the countries of origin, but also to Libya itself, and that was saying that Libya was not a safe place to return migrants to, and that I would think it's fair to say would continue to be the conclusion one would draw from the very poor conditions of detention that exist in migrant detention centres, from the general vulnerability of foreigners without status to extortion, to trafficking, as exemplified by the notorious so-called slave auctions, which is really selling migrants because they're being trafficked. So returning anybody to Libya from these boats exposes them to all of those risks in a meaningful way. That was the conclusion already of the European Court of Human Rights in 2012 in Hirsi Jama. I don't think there's any reason to question that conclusion as still today. The practical result was that the other result was that there was a breach of procedural entitlement. It's an entitlement to have the individual case considered as against Article 3 or especially, but also any other representations that might be made. All those procedural rights ought to have been guaranteed as well. So you had substantive protection against, I suppose it comes down to substantive protection against against refoulement, against being returned to a situation where inhuman or degrading treatment was faced, and a lack of respect for any procedural entitlement to make a case against return, which could be a variety, those could be a variety of things. Now, in thinking about Hirsi Jama, which really is shapes everything that's happened since, it is important to know that although that was an operation which was concerned strictly with interception, so the Italian state authorities set out to stop the boats and to take control of the people involved, the court in Hirsi indicated that it wouldn't have made any difference if it had been a rescue operation. They said, because Italy tried to argue, somewhat counterfactually, it has to be said, that this was a rescue and that made a difference. That some the logic is that if someone's being rescued, they're asking for that, and so you're not taking them under your control. You're assisting them. Okay, that's what Italy was trying to argue, but the court in Hirsi blocked that line of argument. At least this is how it's understood. They didn't just say that's not true here. They said it wouldn't matter if this were a rescue, because still, by being taken on board the vessels, the individuals, the rescued individuals, would then be under the control of the Italian state. So it's been assumed since Hirsi that also those rescued would benefit from all of the same protections. I suppose there's some wiggle room there, but that's not how it's understood. And another interesting thing is that it concluded that it was possible to be expelled from a contracting state of the European Convention, notwithstanding that all the events took place in international waters. And that's not logical, actually, legally. You can't be expelled before arriving. But the court said, well, yes, that is how we're going to interpret specifically the guarantee against collective expulsion, because to do otherwise would undermine the purpose of that protection, because states would be able to get around it by simply encountering foreign nationals before they arrived. So although literally it's not an expulsion, it is legally counting as such for someone to be returned from the high seas to another country by a contracting state. The conclusions also were not limited to what we might call refugees as a shorthand. So the benefit of this ruling was not limited to people who were coming from countries where they faced particular risks. That could have included Somalia and Eritrea, but any other nationality on board, they would also have benefited from the protection against being returned to Libya because of the conditions there, and also the procedural rights to have an expulsion considered, but to be able to make representations about it. So it's not just about people coming from clearly refugee-producing countries. All nationalities potentially benefit. Now, the implication of Hirsi, the practical implication, was that the individuals intercepted or rescued should then be taken to the state in question for processing, because it would be too difficult to process them on board the vessels. That's the practical implication. And in policy terms, it's, while the ruling is welcome from a human rights perspective, welcome in terms of ensuring that legal guarantees can't be avoided by states by engaging in extraterritorial controls, while all of that is true, the difficulty is that it opened then. The question there was what would the states do next? And the logic from their point of view was to disengage from interception and rescue. Clearly from interception, but also from rescue. And a further implication was that they should seek to get other states to do the work to get states not subject to the European Convention, essentially states of departure, to do the work for them. All of this could be predicted as possible scenarios at the time of Hersey, and in a sense, so it has proven to be. Right? That is essentially what has happened over through the migration crisis. Now, so that brings me. That's Hersey, it's a kind of prequel, and then got to look at where we are now, or what's happened in the period of more open crisis for EU migration policy. By the time of Hersey, of course, the Arab Spring had happened and the Libyan civil war was underway. And that, together with Hersey, led to Italy's withdrawal from interception operations. They ceased trying to stop people as an immigration control measure. And they really withdrew altogether from doing anything at sea in the central Mediterranean. And that, of course, then exposed those seeking to travel from Libya to Italian territory to the risk of drowning. And so it proved to be in the first of the tragedies that first two of the tragedies that has marked this route, the Lampedusa tragedies of 2013, it's strange how perceptions have changed, but that at the time was so shocking that it led to an immediate reversal of policy by the Italian government, and they launched a fully fledged rescue operation called Mare Nostrum. In response to the shame, really, of these deaths taking place just off the Italian island of Lampedusa, and that continued for a year or so. It was relatively expensive for the Italian state. It led to a lot of political costs for the government of the time, and they all the time were seeking to get the EU to take it over. And eventually, after a year or so, that is what happened. Operation Triton took it over, although with a more restricted geographical reach and mandate. So that was actually partly withdrawal of relative to the rescue that had been put in place. I personally try to avoid kind of political correctness in this area, I have to be honest, and I think we have to be blunt and say that the Italian authorities rescuing people was a pull factor for those for them to come. And I think you simply have to look at the change from 2013 to 2014 in the number of people reaching Italy by regular routes, by regular journeys from Libya to see that happening. Now, of course, everything is more complicated, but that dynamic, I think, is pretty evident in those numbers. And in a way, since then, the EU and Italy have been trying to avoid getting into a sort of unlimited rescue situation. Operation Triton was the first. That shift to the EU was already an attempt to do so. That itself, because it was a withdrawal, led to further large tragedies in April 2015, when more than 1,000 people died in two tragedies, and that led to that was actually the beginning of the migration crisis as it's commonly understood. Not in 2015; it was in the spring of 2015 that the European agenda on migration was launched. When the EU leaders realised they had a huge credibility problem with their inability to get on top of in any form of migration in the Mediterranean. It wasn't the Turkey, Greece, Western Balkans route. That was the beginning of the migration crisis. It was this tragedy in April 2015. And so the initial response was further rescue to open that up again. But still, I would say, with a degree of reluctance as a long-term solution. And we see other things that have happened since then that show that. We had a naval operation since 2015, aimed at disrupting migrant smuggling, which is a different kind of logic. The NGOs have gotten involved and have been gradually pushed back by the decisions of the Italian authorities. Frontex's own mission has changed to, more recently in 2018, to a more security-focused one. And also, I haven't put it on the list because I'll come to it later, also crucially in 2017, Italy entered a memorandum of understanding with the Libyan authorities, which has been the centerpiece of a much more restrictive and much more effective restrictive policy than previously. And that is the reason why, although this is sort of the beginning of it, in the era of very high numbers from 2014, you can see that we dropped off in 2018 because of that, that's perhaps the accumulation of various initiatives, but particularly focused on the latest Italian-Libyan deal. Now, so what I'm really trying to say is, so just to be clear, my own position is very much one of rescue, disembark, process, return. Okay, so it's not, my position is very much one of saying there should be rescue here. I'm trying to describe what the states, Italy and the EU have been doing. So the question I'm left with is, well, is there any way of really policing state behaviour as regards rescue? Are there international ways of doing that? Now, you may know that states, coastal states, have duties regarding rescue in a general sense. They're obliged to oblige the masters of vessels to give assistance to people in distress at sea, and they're obliged to ensure effective search and rescue off their coasts. There's a well-known grey area around disembarkation of people rescued. There are no specific obligations on any state as regards disembarkation. Even states that engage in organising search and rescue, there are no specific obligations there. And the way search and rescue works, or should work, is that there's the seas are divided into, and they are divided in this area, into search and rescue zones, which different state authorities are responsible for. But the fact that somebody is rescued in the Italian SAR zone does not make Italy responsible for disembarking them in Italy. There's no clarity as yet around that. So that's one big issue. But then there are a whole set of other ones, which I've tried to list here, which is, I'm asking the question, to what extent can international law police rescue, as I said. What does that mean? So that would mean ensuring disembarkation in a safe place, acceptance of the activities of NGOs and potentially commercial vessels. What are the standards as regards cooperation with other states concerning rescue? An obligation to do it, but also maybe limits to the states with which cooperation is acceptable. And also policing response in individual cases. Now, my understanding is that the law of the sea provisions are not specific or demanding enough at that level. They are general obligations to ensure rescue and search and rescue facilities, but they're not... It's hard to translate them to this level of detail to ensure the fullest possible provision for that search and rescue by states. And I suppose my international law question, if you like, is can we go further? And I am particularly drawn to the idea of the right to life as the possible way forward in this area. It may require some creativity, but... it seems to me that this is, because there's a human right then in play. It's not just states sort of talking to one another or concerned with a very historic obligation as regards rescue. It's a human right in play, and also potentially institutions to back it up, institutions to which complaints can be taken. Now, it's really a question. I haven't seen any examples of attempts to litigate this or even to develop it. So I certainly welcome your thoughts. But it is true that while there are positive obligations as regards the right to life, say under the European Convention, it can impose positive obligations on states. They tend to be positive obligations where there are specific risks arising out of criminal activity, and what's being asked for here is a positive duty out of somehow a contextual risk, and indeed a contextual risk that someone has chosen to put themselves in, chosen to expose themselves to. There isn't a precedent, as far as I know, for that. So that some creativity would be needed. Although there will still be some cases beyond that where you could argue on the basis of the right to life, where the risks to someone's life are known. That is to say, they are. If a state was failing to provide rescue facilities that it had available in relation to in a timely way, in relation to vessels that were known to be at risk, or what if a rescue has already occurred and a state is resisting disembarkation? Again, you could say that that is in conflict with the right to life, because it's in conflict with the initial rescue to refuse disembarkation. So there may be, even if it's not possible to say there's a relevant right in relation to the whole context, there may be specific incidents or moments where the right to life is relevant. But of course, as you may know, the issue here is all, for the human rights treaties is about jurisdiction, that there's a jurisdiction threshold to be overcome. And my question there would be still whether we can think about SAR zones and jurisdiction. And that's something that hasn't been done, to the best of my knowledge. Jurisdiction has where jurisdiction is defined geographically it is defined by reference to territory. But could we imagine jurisdiction going to outwards into the rest of the SAR zone, and use some of the evolving jurisprudence actually around jurisdiction, which talks about public power to that end. So this is an area where this is very much my maybe slightly deranged speculations about how the right to life could creatively be used to try to police rescue, because I'm not sure that there's anything in the Law of the Sea instruments, I'm open to correction, but Law of the Sea instruments that can get us there. Right, so that's one set of points about rescue. Then I want to talk about Italian cooperation with the Libyan authorities. I might just skip this slide. Just basically take it from me that both the EU and the Italian government are actively involved with the Libyan authorities in supporting them, training them, funding them when it comes to everything to do with border control, including what are called pullback operations, where the Libyan Coast Guard is rescuing people who've departed from Libya and taking them back to Libyan ports. And these can be both from Libyan territorial waters, but also, particularly controversial, from international waters off Libya. Okay, so I'm not going to go through all the details. The question becomes, or has become, whether Italy has responsibility for any of that, right, as the central EU state, acting in its own right and also encouraging the EU action. We could think about whether Libya has responsibility, okay? I'll get to that next. But just thinking about Italy, so the question as regards to the pullbacks is whether effectively Italy can avoid the Hirsi ruling by subcontracting to the Libyan authorities, putting it at its strongest, okay? By subcontracting in this way to the Libyan authorities. And there is a complaint before the European Court of Human Rights. I think it's to be known as SS against Italy. You can find out about it from newspaper reports, which is arguing exactly that, led by the ASGI, is the Italian immigration law advocates organization, and GLAN is sort of human rights global activist network, which includes academics based here in the United Kingdom. So they're essentially rerunning Hirsi about pullback operations from international waters, or a particular pullback operation. and tried to argue that Italy is responsible because they have control. And I think this is where there are, I have to confess, some difficulties in predicting that they're going to succeed, because where Italy is funding the Libyan Coast Guard, training the Libyan Coast Guard, and there's active cooperation in particular operations, still does that amount of control by Italy of the migrants concerned who are rescued? Is that still enough for Italy to have control? It requires a more flexible reading of the concept of control as developed so far. It seems to be controlled through a third party. not to say it's impossible. Certainly if you look at some of the things in Hirsi, as I explained, there's a purposive approach taken in, definitely in one place, to say, well, the guarantees of the convention will be undermined unless we reach this conclusion. You could take that view here, that a purposive view is necessary, even when thinking about jurisdiction, to say, well, if we don't stop Italy subcontracting to the Libyan Coast Guard in international waters at least, then the guarantees are undermined. But it's not obvious that there is control in the sense in which that term has been used, control over an individual in the sense that that term has been used previously in the court's jurisprudence. So it's a kind of new ground, a new argument being run. I would have other questions which may, if this case gets it's argued out, may well emerge. I've said that there may be issues about the degree. Is there sufficient control over the agents of the other state? What if they have their own freedom of decision making? Does that negative control anyway? There will also be questions about if any principle like this is established, does it apply within Libyan territorial waters too? What does it matter where Italy is subcontracting to the Libyan authorities if the argument is accepted? What about disruptive activity on land or arrest on land? If this case succeeds, the question of the outer limits will still be left unresolved, and that may be a reason why this case won't succeed, because that will trouble the judges. And it's also a tricky issue to which is about the rights, but goes to the jurisdiction issue, I think, is, okay, if we say that Italy does have jurisdiction where the Libyan authorities are acting, the Libyan Coast Guard is acting, well, what exactly are Italy's obligations? And when you start... do they have the same obligations not to have somebody returned to Libya, same obligations as regards processing as they would have under Hirsi? When you start to ask that question, you start to see how difficult it is to say yes, and once it becomes difficult to say yes to those duties, it then becomes difficult to see what jurisdiction means, because you're saying that if you're saying they can't really do those things, well then how can they have jurisdiction in the first place? So it's a fascinating challenge. It may not work, but whichever way it goes, I think assuming it gets argued out and decided on, we will learn a lot about the scope of human rights principles in relation to cooperation with other states. There is a second line of argument. This is my last. Detailed point is about which is based on complicity. Even if we say that when the Libyan Coast Guard acts, Italy doesn't have jurisdiction, but still maybe Italy could have responsibility indirectly for complicity in international wrongs by the Libyan authorities. And this kind of argument is known, is accepted in international law, including human rights law, based on Article 16 of the ILC draft articles on state responsibility. I don't think it's that difficult to get the argument started that Italy might be indirectly responsible through the aid and assistance that it is undoubtedly giving to the Libyan authorities. Where I get a little bit lost as to how this will play out is when it comes to identifying the internationally wrongful acts of the two states. It's necessary to have that. Both states would have to have committed some international wrong. The acting state has to commit an international wrong, and the assisting state, it would have to be an international wrong for them too. This can actually be difficult to pin down in the kind of scenario we're describing, and that's because you're essentially saying that the Libyan authorities are committing an international wrong by bringing somebody back to Libya. The way we think in migration law, international migration law, is that it's expulsion to another state is an international wrong, not keeping somebody in your own state or bringing them back. And we get in here to, there's a very sort of interesting set of arguments about the boundaries between the non-refoulement principle in its various manifestations. This is non-expulsion, international protection obligation, versus the right to leave any state. And there's a question as to whether those actually, you can't have both at the same time. Or maybe there's some overlap. It's again, thinking about Libya, it's somewhat difficult to say, well, specifically which obligations would Libya be violating? Is it violating an international protection obligation if it takes somebody back from international waters to itself? Maybe it is. Maybe because it's not, because it's just about exposing them to the inhuman or degrading treatment. I suppose that, yes, you could say that. It's not a typical refugee case, that's for sure. But maybe yes. Can they violate the right to leave anywhere? Where do they violate it? Again, maybe yes. We could say they could violate it in their own territorial waters. They're stopping somebody leaving. They could violate it potentially in international waters. De facto, that's stopping them leaving as well. If it gets down to the right to leave and not non-refoulement, I think there is going to be, it's a tricky issue because they can argue they're rescuing them and not blocking them. They're saving them, not constraining them. That kind of argument doesn't work so well if it's exposure to inhuman or degrading treatment. So in the end, I'm thinking this through, probably there's a lot more chance if it's an international protection-based obligation, although that's a little bit harder to work out. Than if it's the right to leave. But interestingly, just a final point, both Italy and Libya are parties to not just to the ICCPR, which protects both of these rights, but also to the optional protocol permitting individual complaints. And, not that I'm aware of, but I hope someday somebody is going to sue the two states, really, arising out of these kind of issues. I think I've gone on rather long. I will I just leave my concluding slide there. Just to say that I've been writing, thinking about this stuff for about 10 years, and it's extraordinary to me how the story just keeps going and going and going, and I don't expect it to stop anytime soon. Thanks very much.